Welcome back. This is Background Briefing with Ian Masters, although today it's with Tom Lutz, and I'm joined with by Tom Hayden and Seth Greenland. We were just talking about youth movements. Your latest book, Tom, is about youth movements, the kind of history of the youth movements.
That's right. I've had an interesting journey because I've watched the pattern for 50 years, and one of the things that we stood for in the old days was participatory democracy, and I see that as ironically as like a gift that keeps on giving. In other words, just when you think everything is conformist and quiet, along comes out of nowhere comes a movement led by young people that surprises and that opens up a lot of possibilities. I think another example, probably the most important the past couple of years, has been the movement for the DREAM Act by young undocumented immigrants, many of them here in Los Angeles, but all around the country, who are having a national convention. I wonder what the FBI think, the police think of that. It's a national convention of hundreds and thousands of people in Kansas City who are here illegally. And they've just succeeded in a de facto temporary amnesty and are cooking up their plans for next steps in terms of legislation, state and federal levels. And 2 years ago, they were hardly a speck in the eye. They are here today, and I think they probably achieved more under Obama through direct action and lobbying than any other movement in the country, with possible exception of the LGBT movement.
And I don't know how far we want to get into this, but it strikes me that perhaps we can think of Bradley Manning not as a movement, but as a young activist.
I think Bradley Manning is like a conscience of the generation. He reminds me, if you read his diaries, his blogs, it's a little like the Allen Ginsberg character in Howl. I would suggest to the LA Review that you look carefully at them with an eye to publishing them or putting them out as a pamphlet. The anguish of this young man, who was a closeted gay soldier at the time that the gays in the military issue was ripening to, a new level, and who was a technician and looking at the logs of all of these atrocities, secretly inflicted atrocities, it had this profound alteration of his consciousness. It kind of broke his heart, and he became kind of crazy at what he was seeing on the screen, and that led him then to the disclosures for which he's on trial. But I don't think there's a movement for Bradley Manning, but there should be. But there's certainly a movement against excessive classification, and a movement to protect whistleblowers, like Assange and Manning. There may have to be new legal architecture concerning whistleblowing, but certainly they should not be punished with life imprisonment or that sort of thing, because they have revealed secrets that the American people, American taxpayers, American families are entitled to know about what we did in Iraq and these other places.
How do you deal with a Bradley Manning, though, because I agree with you. I think there are certain things in a democracy that we need to know, and there are other things that perhaps it's impossible to operate a government without a certain amount of secrecy. Would you agree with that, or do you think a government should be entirely transparent?
That's a good question. No, I can't justify entire transparency. It's kind of a marginal to me, because the possibility of that in my lifetime and yours is just beyond my imagination. I'm trying to keep the shadows from falling further and the curtains from closing altogether. If I were looking at it from the White House point of view, I would say, well, you know, we have to keep some of these things secret. But, ladies and gentlemen, we have gone so overboard in secret classifications. There are so many tens of thousands of people with security clearances. These documents are being classified in order to prevent the exposure of embarrassment and scandal, not anything that jeopardizes our real security. And I would issue a presidential order to rapidly increase the declassification of documents. With respect to Manning, you know, you're president, you can't let somebody go, but you could say that he's, you know, he's paid his price, he's suffered enough. He was manhandled badly at Quantico, and a careful review of the documents shows that, you know, no American personnel have been injured or put in harm's way as a result of what was disclosed, and, you know, give him a pathway back to civilian life. Don't make him a scapegoat of a horrific and secretive war begun by under several presidents. Bush is out. Manning's in prison. Does that make sense to you?
And I worry that they will make a John Walker Lind example of him, which I personally don't think he deserves.
Yeah.
That's another one. John Walker Lind, at least I think, will be out. I think they brokered a deal.
Mm. Let's move to questions of justice. Thanks very much, Seth Greenland, for joining us. And now we have on the line Don Franzen, an attorney who specializes in entertainment and business law. Don is a fellow at the Los Angeles Institute for the Humanities and is the legal editor for the LA Review of Books. He has a special interest in the Supreme Court, as I suppose most of us do these days, and has recently written about the Affordable Health Care Act decision, and even more recently interviewed Justice Antonin Scalia for us. Welcome, Don.
Hello, welcome, Tom. Thank you.
Glad you could join us. Tom and I were talking yesterday about the Roberts Court and the possibility that the 5-4 majority might change during the next 4 or 5 years. Don, have you looked at the actuarial calendars, the charts?
There you go. Yeah, the results, the election in November was potentially very momentous for the composition of the court, because as everybody, I think, who's read many newspapers in the last 4 years has noticed, is that it's essentially 4 solid conservative votes and 4 more or less solid liberal votes, and then Kennedy in the center being almost the kind of the Ohio, as it were, of the Supreme Court, you know, the vote you have to win in order to win. And coming up in the next 4 years, we have several justices who are getting up in years, or at least what most of us would consider up in years. Kennedy himself is 76. So is Scalia, although having just interviewed him, I have to say he's a very hearty 76. But Ruth Bader Ginsburg is about to turn 80 and has not been in particularly good health for some time, unfortunately. So we might, it would be reasonable to expect, and also Stephen Breyer is 74. So between all of those, there's the chance for one, possibly as much as 4 seats in the Supreme Court coming up during Obama's second term. So at a minimum, if actuarially speaking, we guess that Ginsburg, as the oldest, it would be the first to retire or leave the court for some reason. That would just be replacing a liberal vote, so that wouldn't change the court's composition. But should any of the others, Breyer also being a liberal vote, that wouldn't change the court's composition. But if for some reason Kennedy should have to step down, there might be a chance to actually change the 5-4 composition in the other direction. So actually what happened in November was very, very important for the future of the court.
And Tom, you were looking at a 5 or 6 year timeline.
Well, that's why I said, you know, Hillary Clinton as a presidential candidate is extremely important, assuming that she's as viable in the future as she is now, because this business about the court is very often misunderstood at the grassroots level. But I'm glad for Mr. Franzen's analysis there. My sense is that Obama will get one for sure, but he needs two, and that may take till the next president.
That's right. And if the second one is Breyer, then that doesn't change anything, really. We'll still have the kind of 4-4 and one swing vote composition that we have now.
That's correct. I think it may take the next president to get to more, but I don't know. I do think that I take as my viewpoint on this stuff Jeff Toobin's book, which I'm sure you've reviewed and read, and I think what Toobin says in his book should remind us of how important it can be to in fact politicize the court, if you will. I don't mean to put it quite so baldly, but it is politicized. It is a Republican majority, and we lost the Gore presidency because of these folks. And it doesn't need to be a left-wing court. It doesn't need to be a Democratic Party loyalist court, but it needs to be an independent judiciary. That's the point. And it could be that public pressure actually, as Toobin argues, made Justice Roberts obligated to protect the institutional interests of the court, not just his own extremely conservative agenda. What do you think?
That's exactly, I think, what happened. In fact, going back to the LA Review of Books, we ran an article on, like, the day after of the health care decision. Actually, I ran a review of a book that covered like the different theories of the Constitution, and commented on the fact that Roberts was maybe for the second time in history the switch in time that saved nine, because he was concerned about the institution of the court and wanted to preserve its neutrality and not have it be perceived as a political arm of one party or the other. So, yes, I think that's exactly what happened. He was probably acting more as a statesman than a partisan politician in doing that. So it's quite remarkable when you think about it that it was the health care law, the Affordable Health Care Act, was one vote away from being declared unconstitutional. I mean, it just squeaked by. We haven't had a situation like that since the 1930s, where a major act of national legislation seeking to address a large national problem and issue practically got overturned. You remember, Tom, you know history as well as anybody. I mean, you're a student of history. You know how the Supreme Court got in trouble in the 1930s by routinely overturning New Deal legislation and practically almost destroyed itself as an institution. So that's probably what Roberts, I think he had that in mind. And
I think it's in their DNA. But we'll see if it was just a temporary protective measure, because they could go after the Voting Rights Act, affirmative action. There's a whole number of other issues that are coming right down the road now that the election's
that's
over.
That's exactly right. If you look at the scorecard, I mean, coming up pretty soon is the Prop 8 case, the ban on gay marriage. They right. have some big affirmative action cases coming. Yep. They've got voting rights cases coming up about whether even to continue the Voting Rights Act in the South. They've got there'll be more litigation over campaign finance, federalist issues about the rights of states and their power to deal with illegal immigrants. So there's a lot of big issues in the pipeline for the court to deal with in the next year or two.
Thanks very much, Don. We're going to have to take a quick break. And when we come back, I'm going to be adding Ruben Martinez into the conversation. Thanks very much for being with us, Don.
My pleasure. Thanks.